From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. What was really going on in that phone call between the Big Ten commissioner and the president?
There was no chance that that phone call was going to be like, hey, I have an idea that you hadn't considered, Kevin Warren, and once I explain it to you, you'll say, wow, that's genius, and start your football season in a week.
Today, the latest chapter in 2020's story of sports at the center of politics. Elsewhere, Michigan moves to address COVID-related problems in nursing homes.
People recognize that the other health threat in nursing homes right now is isolation. It has a huge impact on residents' mental health.
Also, a Detroit photographer's ice fishing trips with her dad show her how key winter is to the Great Lakes.
I started to go out with him on the ice and photograph, talk to other ice anglers. I really saw Midwestern culture come to life.
The result, a breathtaking photo essay for National Geographic. Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. A big spread in National Geographic magazine is dedicated to exploring how the number of frozen days has decreased dramatically on the Great Lakes over the past 40 years. Today on the show, we'll explore the thawing of the lakes with photojournalist Amy Sacca.
I started photographing all the things that were happening around the open water and how people were adapting to the fact that there was no ice.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, college sports fans were just starting to adjust to a likely reality of fall without football when hope was dangled before them this week. President Donald Trump placed a phone call to Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren to discuss what might expedite the start of the football season. Big Ten games, like those of several other conferences, are in limbo because of COVID-19. Michael Rosenberg is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, and we called him from his location inside the NBA bubble at the happiest place on earth, Disney World's compound in Orlando, Florida. Michael, welcome to Stateside. Can we just take a minute to envision the mood in Big Ten President Kevin Warren's office when the word came down the president is holding for the commissioner? I mean, what do you think flashed through his head? Should I say I'm out to lunch? Should I say I'm in a staff meeting or doing a Zoom call with Pope Francis? I'm sure that can't be a phone call that any sports executive is excited to take.
I imagine that those calls are kind of like when you have to do the first dance at a wedding that you don't approve of the choice, and you just kind of, well, I'll just get through the dance and be done with it. So, you know, it was obviously, there's a political reason there. We all know where the swing states are. A lot of them are in Big Ten territory. There was no chance, no matter how it was spun or how the news was written, that that phone call was going to change the Big Ten's decision or plans. But it certainly dominated the news cycle for a little while, and the Big Ten's going to go back to doing what they've been doing, which is sort of punting, if you will, down a couple months and see if they can pull off a season starting probably in November at the earliest.
Yeah, President Trump was leading folks to believe that we might be, in his words, very nicely surprised. Your read on that?
Yeah, he said it was the one-yard line, and a few people said, well, he didn't say which one-yard line. Do you have one yard
right
to go or 99 for the Big Ten? Let's be realistic. There was no chance that that phone call was going to be like, hey, I have an idea that you hadn't considered, Kevin Warren, and once I explain it to you, you'll say, wow, that's genius, and start your football season in a week. I mean, there was no chance that they were going to get granular about it or have some sort of revelation about it. They just did it. I mean, Kevin Warren couldn't say no, because then it was he said no. So it was a PR thing. It was a political thing. It really didn't have a lot of effect on any sort of reality within the Big Ten.
What do you think the president gains in trying to get involved in collegiate football schedule?
Well, I mean, look, let's face it. I don't know if you've heard. I believe there is a presidential election this
mm-hmm.
year, as I recall. And it's not just about what you're accomplishing. It is about the perception of what you're trying to accomplish. And if President Trump has created the perception among people who deeply care about this issue that he is pushing to get things open, he is pushing for schools, he is pushing for football to be played, whether the schools are open and football is played, that almost doesn't matter. What matters is that those who wanted that to happen believe he's on their side. And that's all this really was.
What might have some influence on whether the Big Ten or any of the other conferences taking a pass reverse course?
Well, I think one advantage of saying November, and the Big Ten's obviously gotten a lot of heat from this, but The SEC and the Big 12, some of these leagues are starting soon. I mean, some college football is being played already. If they can pull this off and there are not masses of positive tests, then the Big Ten kind of has a blueprint to go forward with it, with its plan and with its schedule. If the SEC shuts down in early October because there are so many COVID tests on campus, so many cases on campus, and teams can't play and they just decide it's not safe, then the Big Ten looks smart. So I really think it's going to depend on whether or not other conferences can pull this off.
Mike, you're in Orlando right now, and you have written about Major League Baseball's struggles to get through some kind of season if the restart happens. Are you holding your breath that the demi-season for college football will play out?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I'll tell you the ways in which I am holding my breath. We did a story a couple of weeks ago in which we polled 150 or so medical professionals around the country and basically said, under the current protocols for each league, would you play? And the overwhelming number said they would play in the NHL or NBA, which have a bubble, and they would not play in the NFL or Major League Baseball, which don't have a bubble. And what we realized as reporting that story is that those leagues define success by finishing the season. If there is a Super Bowl and Roger Goodell can hand a trophy to someone, he's going to say this word.
It's a win.
And
yeah.
What the doctors are saying is, that's not how we define success. You don't want anything to do with this virus. And so my concern is not so much whether they finish the season. I'm worried that some 320-pound lineman will get sick and never be the same again or even worse. So that's really my concern more than whether or not they can play the games.
All this is playing out while the NBA has been getting through its playoffs process. I have so many questions about Orlando. First of all, what has the mood been like this past week?
Well, I've mostly seen the mood from my bed, my bathroom, and then the chair in my room, because I'm not allowed to leave for a week except to go get tested every day. But I've talked to a number of people who are here, and, you know, it's weird. I mean, I think people are homesick. I think that the players are having a tougher time than they're probably admitting in most cases. But I also think there's a real respect and admiration for the NBA and the Players Association for pulling this off. I mean, this kind of bubble has never really been tried before, and so far it's working magnificently. So and the basketball's been good. So it's different. I don't think anyone wants to do it again, but it's certainly been a success so far.
For sure. What is it like having so little control? I mean for the players, but maybe also for the coaches and the teams, and maybe just for you too.
Well, it's just everything about it just feels so different. I was talking to somebody in the media who said, you know, it's kind of like watching a game on a spaceship, like, except you actually know who those players are. I mean, it's just bizarre. It's very different. And there was an interesting thing that happened in the Oklahoma City Houston series, because I believe that the winner gets to move to the nicer hotel, and then because other teams have cleared out. But if you're a coach, you can't kind of throw that carrot out to your team, because the loser gets to go to an even nicer place, which is out of here. You know, they get to go home. So you don't want to plant that seed at all with your players. It's different. I mean, players are making the best of it. I think they're, you know, they're not going to complain, because they still have it better than most of America, obviously. But also, like most of America, or pretty much all of America, life's not quite as good as it was a year ago, and they've got to adjust to it.
The NBA is getting so much attention also for the way that its players are reacting to Black Lives Matter, in sometimes in very verbal ways and sometimes just in the visual ways, in the case of their jerseys and the messages on the back. Sports have always been as political as the athletes who play them. Why do you think it is that the sports world found itself at the center of American politics in this moment?
Well, there are a few factors. I mean, we just can't discount the rise of President Trump and Trumpism. I think that a lot of things are being said out loud that people were kind of saying quietly before, and to some degree, the current administration is a pushback against Obama being elected, and then a lot of what you're seeing now is a pushback against Trump being elected. But the other part of it, with the pandemic, it's sort of made everybody reevaluate everything. People have time. I mean, we've seen so many protests over issues happening in the country that are not really new issues, but because of what's happened this year, when people have time and they're thinking about it and they're reading the news and they're not socializing and they're not distracted, they're acting. And I think the NBA players are like that too. And once that got momentum, It's not going to stop. And I think if you look at this generation of NBA players, they're different. I mean, they're very used to having power over their own careers, over the league, over their image, over their stories and how they are presented publicly. They are very socially aware. They are very interested in all of that. And so there were so many factors that were sort of ready there or already in play before this happened, and now they're acting, and this means a lot to these guys. I mean, we're always talking about forever, as long as I've been watching sports, whenever somebody succeeds, people say, well, you don't want to forget where you came from. Well, these guys don't forget where they came from. I mean, so when LeBron James says that could be me, what he's saying is, if I were not LeBron James, if you didn't know who I was, that could be me. I could be George Floyd. And I think that's pretty powerful, and hopefully it'll make a difference.
What do you see as the long-term dividends of NBA players, but maybe also college athletes of all stripes, finding their power in this moment?
Well, some of this is going to play out over the next 5 or 10 or 20 years, and we'll have to look back at this year in particular and say, wow, what changed and how did it change? Because it's hard to make sense of it in the moment. I mean, the Mississippi State flag changed because of a college athletes. I mean, that is a concrete change that happened. Larger scale changes, for athletes' rights, for collegians, financially, it's hard to say where all this is going. Some of that, again, some of those seeds are already planted, but this is going to be a different world in ways that we don't fully understand yet until we get through it.
Mike Rosenberg is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. You may remember him from his time at the Detroit Free Press as well. Michael, stay safe out there.
Thank you, April.
After the break, the political calculations at work in presidential dealings with African Americans, from George Washington to Donald Trump.
Part of the problem that we face as a nation in dealing with issues of race is that for a long, long time, white people have not really been listening to black people.
That's straight ahead. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. President Donald Trump visited Kenosha, Wisconsin this week. Even as demonstrations continue over the recent police shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man, and a subsequent shooting in which a white teenager opened fire on Black Lives Matter protesters in the region, killing 2. U.S. presidents have not, by and large, demonstrated a strong grasp on the subject of race relations. Stephen Jones recently co-wrote an essay published on the website The Conversation titled, "Presidents Have a Long History of Condescension, Indifference, and Outright Racism Toward Black Americans." Jones is an adjunct instructor of history at Central Michigan University. Stephen Jones, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So President Trump went ahead with his visit to Kenosha at a time when America is really divided. There are many people who support Black Lives Matter, but some white people and even some people of color see images of protests and they feel uneasy. What are some things that a presidential visit might have accomplished at a time like this?
It might have accomplished some calming if that was the demeanor of the visit, if there was, you know, an indication of sincere concern that recognized that whatever the specific facts of the initial shooting, that this series of events in Kenosha are part of a much, much bigger picture that has to be factored into our thinking when we try to approach how to deal with a particular incident. And a display of genuine concern, of some understanding of that complexity can be helpful, I think, in persuading the American public that there's some thoughtful deliberation going on in how to respond to and how to deal with the specific circumstances in Kenosha or some other place where some of these incidents have happened.
The schedule included a visit to the site of some protests, a tour of an emergency operations center, and a roundtable in which a reporter asked two Black ministers about systemic police violence, and President Trump jumped in and answered for them, stating he doesn't think it's an issue. He did not visit Jacob Blake's family. What do you think he accomplished?
Well, I think I did not see that specific exchange, but if he did, as you described, jumped in and spoke for the Black ministers, he added to the problem. Part of the problem that we face as a nation in dealing with issues of race is that for a long, long time, white people have not really been listening to Black people when it comes to how they perceive these issues. You know, ideally, President Trump would recognize that whether he sees it as an issue is not nearly so important as him recognizing that the African American community certainly sees it as an issue. And, you know, that's, you know, until we recognize that, until we have leaders who can see that and recognize and acknowledge that the African American community has a perspective that is built on a long, long history of being treated disrespectfully and in many cases very brutally by authorities in police departments all over this country, we're not going to be able to resolve any of these issues. We won't be able to move forward until we acknowledge all of that.
You and your colleague wrote this essay that I mentioned, giving a historical survey of some 19th and 20th century presidents and talking about their attitudes toward race. What was the unifying theme for you among all these case studies?
Well, for me, the unifying idea is that we have to be much more thorough and deeper in our thinking when we look at the role of presidents. One of the comments on the that we got on that article was that someone objected to us mentioning, say, Ulysses Grant, who once owned a slave, with someone like Woodrow Wilson, who was a thoroughgoing white supremacist. I mean, he was dignified in his language, in his use of language, but he, you know, segregated federal offices in D.C. and refused to come out in opposition to lynching, or at least when he finally did, it didn't recognize that African Americans were the main targets of lynching. And it's true that all of the presidents, each president has his own particular strengths and or weaknesses. I mean, Grant did own a slave. He, for about a year or year and a half before he freed that slave. Mm-hmm. It was a slave that had been given to him by his father-in-law. And Grant undeniably did an awful lot through winning the Civil War, but also sending federal troops into the South as president to help restrain the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist organizations that were attacking African Americans. But still, you know, there was, you know, he was also a product of his time. He was not, I'm not a specialist on Grant, but I'm not aware that he ever expressed an idea that whites and blacks were equal. And so what we have to do is we have to avoid lionizing our former presidents and recognize the totality of their records and recognize the extent to which their leadership has either contributed to the problem or not been effective in resolving the problems of race in America.
A lot of people may have heard that Abraham Lincoln's views on Black Americans were, as you say, complex. I mean, he made pivotal decisions about slavery and the future of Black Americans during the Civil War, but he did not believe that Black Americans were equal to white ones. But that was not a huge surprise in the essay. But there was some very interesting information in there about another president who followed Lincoln, who undid much of the work of abolition. Can you explain what was going on in America when Rutherford B. Hayes was campaigning to become president?
Yes, the presidential election of 1876 was, until 2000, was the most contested election. There have been some very contested elections, but this one was a real cliffhanger in the same way that the election in 2000 was, where several states' electoral votes were being challenged. And it, you know, went to Congress to have to decide, and it was, you know, there was this haggling back and forth, and it was dragging on and dragging on. And finally, there was a deal cut whereby the Democrats would accept Hayes as the person elected. They would stop disputing the electoral votes in a way that would allow Hayes to become president. But the payoff for that was that he agreed to basically have the federal troops stand down in the South. You know, the progress that, to the extent that Grant had sent troops in, and there were, I mean, there were congressional hearings. There were just vicious and brutal attacks on African Americans in the South. I mean, just murders and mass killings, and, you know, throughout the Reconstruction period and after. And Hayes, although he spoke in his inaugural address of ensuring fairness and equity to African Americans as well as to whites, you know, the deal that he cut assured that they would not be protected in the South, and that whites would be able to reestablish white supremacy all across the South, which is what they did. And over the next two decades, they effectively, I mean, there have been about 2,000 African Americans elected to public office, you know, most, the vast majority of them in the South. By 1900, they were virtually, black office holders were essentially non-existent. And several thousand African Americans had been lynched. And the number of African Americans who were able to vote in the South, like in Louisiana, the one place I'm aware of some numbers, was reduced between two presidential election cycles by something like 90%. And so that was all the result of Hayes cutting the deal to become president.
If you're just joining us, our guest today is Stephen Jones. He teaches history at Central Michigan University and recently co-authored an essay on U.S. presidents and how they've handled issues of race. There is so much cringeworthy material that you put forward in the essay, and it really stretches over a long period of time. As I was reading it, I was thinking about how even a president like Barack Obama, as historic as he was, you know, sometimes progressives look at what happened during his time as in office and say he was not able to make systemic change, you know, because he was the first. Mm-hmm. Do you think that civil rights has ever been more than a talking point in terms of presidential politics?
Oh, yeah, I think it has. But I think that the attention that civil rights have been given, you know, it often, the discussions often get derailed in a variety of other political matters. But the most prominent example that comes to mind quickly was the election of 1948, when Harry Truman, who was a Southerner, I mean, he was from Missouri and had been raised, you know, by a grandma, you know, grandmother who just like thought of Abraham Lincoln as the devil. And so he grew in the office of the presidency. And when he saw the way that African-American veterans were being treated, were being lynched in a number of cases in Southern states in the wake of the war, he grew in his commitment to being the president of all the people. And he set up a commission on civil rights. He issued an executive order finally desegregating the military. And he did so at considerable political risk. He almost lost the election of 1948 because of his assertive stand on civil rights. The so-called Dixiecrats walked out of the Democratic convention and ran Strom Thurmond for president on a third-party ticket, and won, I think, four states. So Truman paid a political price, but he made the commitment. But still, there was a man who personally, I mean, you know, he still used the N-word in the White House. He was a complex man. And we need to recognize that. I mean, that our leaders of all political stripes are human beings. They are shaped by the societies they live in. They sometimes, without even being aware of and recognizing how they have been shaped by racial attitudes, will take positions that, you know, that are not as enlightened as would be ideal.
When you are in the classroom, I wonder how much you find your students know about the depth of United States race relations. You know, by the time they reach the undergraduate level, do they know much of the history that you would want them to have as a grounding for this?
Actually, no. I mean, they know some of the broad strokes. They've heard of the Emancipation Proclamation, but they'll tell you that they'll give you the shorthand version that Lincoln freed the slaves, which isn't quite right. He did and he didn't. It depends, and that's what I try to point out to them. It's a very complex issue. You know, the proclamation only applied to those parts of the country that he had no control over,
right?
And yet it helped prevent Britain and France, who desperately wanted Southern cotton, prevented by starting to make the war about slavery rather than just preserving the Union. It kept them out of trying to press for a negotiated settlement. And that accelerated the process. It also gave slaves more motivation as they saw Union Army forces approaching to run away on their own. So it is a complicated story. And you know that, and so the students know some of that, but they don't know. There are a lot of things they don't know. For example, Rosa Parks. I mean, they are startled oftentimes to find out that she wasn't just some poor old middle-aged woman who was tired from the day's work and was too tired to get up from her seat and let a white man sit down. As Rosa Parks herself said on more than one occasion. I think I've got the quote right. The only tired I was tired of being pushed around.
Yeah, the incident was sort of crafted with intention to bring attention to the problem.
And she had been a civil rights activist, civil rights and labor activist for 20 years by the time she got arrested. They're not aware of that. They look at the civil rights movement and they're aware of Martin Luther King in the March on Washington, but they don't understand that King and his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, didn't constitute anywhere near the totality of the civil rights movement, that there were many other organizations involved, and that he didn't lead all the marches. I mean, the lunch counter sit-ins that are so iconic, you know, King wasn't directly involved for the most part in that, certainly not in their origin. Those were started by college students.
Right.
And so you had a lot of young people, one of whom was John Lewis, you know, God rest his soul, who had the youth and the energy and the commitment to go out on their own and start some of the protests. And the students don't generally know a lot of that. And so I try to fill them in. And sometimes I'll get comments, you know, particularly I remember one when I was talking about Rosa Parks and her actual background, students saying, why are we just learning about this now? And they were history majors in college. And so, you know, we don't pay enough attention to it. We don't teach our children enough about the depth and complexity and extent of the struggle that this country's been involved in since the founding. Since its founding, we've been struggling over this issue of civil rights. Who's entitled to the rights of citizenship? Who gets the freedom that we say we stand for? And it saddens me, not just to see how little my students know, but because I know that that reflects how little the whole country, particularly white America, really understands about this.
Stephen Jones is an adjunct instructor of history at Central Michigan University and recently co-authored an essay on U.S. presidents and how they've handled issues of race. thank you so much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're always glad to hear your takes, whether it's the post-COVID economy, protests, what's happening to kids or seniors during the pandemic, or anything else that's on your mind. Send us an email. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page or hit us on Twitter. Our handle is Stateside Radio. Next up, the thawing of the Great Lakes, seen through the lens of a photographer working for National Geographic.
I started photographing all the things that were happening around the open water and how people were adapting to the fact that there was no ice.
It's coming up on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In the latest issue of National Geographic magazine, you'll find a big spread dedicated to exploring how the number of frozen days has dramatically decreased on the Great Lakes over the past 40 years. The photos you'll see of not-so-solid lake water and people navigating generally warmer Michigan winters, these photos were taken by Detroit photojournalist Amy Sacca. A native Michigander, she joins us now. Amy Sacca, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Was your family outdoors much in Michigan winters when you were growing up?
Oh, yes. Yes. My dad has ice fished on the Great Lakes for 50 years. So it's been a big part of our family tradition and culture for as long as I can remember.
What kind of winter memories do you have of being out on the ice?
Well, so this was something when I was growing up that was primarily my father's activity.
What, you weren't into getting out there and freezing your keister off in the shed? I'm shocked.
Well, it was much colder back then, right? And but so anyway, yeah, my memories as a kid were that winter mornings were his, and it was his time to go out before the sun would rise. And he would come back around the time that we would wake up, and he would have all these fish. And it was a little bit of a mystery as to what he was doing out there. And I wasn't particularly interested in fishing at the time. So I'd be sleeping in, right? Waiting for breakfast. And so as I got older and began a photography career, I became very interested in what his experience was like. And so about 4 years ago, I started to go out with him on the ice and photograph what he was up to and talk to other ice anglers on the ice. And I really saw Midwestern culture come to life.
A couple of winters ago, you got a grant to work with National Geographic in a project that was sort of a precursor to what we see in the magazine right now, in which you drove around Michigan looking for lake ice. What did you find on that trip?
That was a very interesting year because we had a lot of ice that year. And if you look at ice patterns, we have high ice years and low ice years. But the trend is a downward trend. And so that winter, I was able to get out on the ice quite a bit. I think I spent 70 days on the ice.
Yeah, it was a 10,000-mile road trip. It's just astonishing.
It was. And one of the things that I'm most proud of about that trip and that project is that I got the grant through iPhone photos that I had taken with my dad on Lake St. Clair the year before, and my dad and I had plotted out a path to write this grant. What could I do that was feasible in a short winter? And so I applied for the grant. I got it. It was the first time that I had worked with National Geographic. And my dad was a big part of following me along the journey, giving me advice on where to go. It really means a lot to me to bring attention to these issues. So that was the beginning of the project, and I wasn't sure if I would go on the ice again, but here we are.
Right.
A year or two later, and I was back out there.
And the conditions are starkly different. What were the places?
They are.
What were the places that you wanted to go for this updated piece? Again, the first one was just an online. This actually appears in the magazine.
So I decided to go out on the ice again. I was actually doing a story for another outlet, and I couldn't find any ice. It was, I think, late January or early January. Normally, there's ice on Lake St. Clair, at least at that point. So I went up to Lake Superior looking for it because I thought, I've got to get on the ice. And I thought for sure on Lake Superior, there'd be something. But I got up there and I saw that there was no ice up there. And the first night I was there, I stayed in a cabin in Paradise, Michigan, and I talked to the owners, and they said, the only reason you could book a room in our cabin is because we had snowmobilers who were supposed to stay here. We were fully booked, but they had to cancel because there was no snow. And so I photographed the hotel owner. And as we were going around Lake Superior, I started photographing all the things that were happening around the open water and how people were adapting to the fact that there was no ice. So I photographed surfers. I photographed just people walking around in shorts. And so I decided at that point, what if I drove around all five of the Great Lakes and looked at how this trend is affecting different communities?
Now, the spread includes a satellite image of all five lakes taken in February, and none of them has very much ice on it. Do you have a sense of how new a phenomenon that is?
I would say it's in the past 20 years, there's been a real difference. Now, the entryway for me to this project was hearing the stories of fishermen like my father who remember growing up and being able to drive their cars across the ice. And that has dramatically changed. There's no way you could do that today. It was a repeated theme that I would hear from people was, we can't fish the way that we used to fish. And if you look at that satellite image, it's astonishing. I think it was taken in late February. That is prime fishing time. My father could not get out on the ice once last year.
It looks like from the photos, there are many ways in which the cultural fabric of the state has been affected by there being less ice. You mentioned fishing, of course, tourism. There's this wonderful photo of the Shandy Days Festival in Caseville, and it just looks like a slush fest.
Yeah, actually, they were really lucky on that weekend to have a bit of ice, but
it's not much. Could you describe the image?
Yes. So they have a great polar bear dip that they do every year, and I have photographed it twice. And everybody puts on their swimsuits. And this particular image, there was a woman who was jumping in and her arms are outstretched. And it's a pretty dramatic photo. But I've got to tell you, if you look at those spreads, that's one of the only spreads where you can see some ice.
Lake Erie is the shallowest of the Great Lakes. And some of the starkest images that you came up with came from Lake Erie. There's a gorgeous sunrise at Presque Isle State Park over a completely thawed pond in the middle of winter, a city park on a January day that barely even looks like winter. And then there's this one of a tween girl in Cleveland running around in her shorts in January. I mean, I can just tell you, people in Northeast Ohio, just like people in Michigan, joke about being A-OK with less ice. But what did you find people saying there about the changes?
Yeah, Lake Erie is one where we are, as you mentioned, it's a shallow lake. So the first time I did this project, that was my go-to lake. The ice is very thick when we have, you know, high ice years. And so it was very strange to go to places like Breast Bay, where they draw walleye fishermen from everywhere to go on the ice, and there was no ice. And then as I went around the lake, as you mentioned, I met a girl named Gracie who was wearing shorts, and I ran up to her and she just said, "It's just not cold enough." And then as I made my way around the lake, I looked out my window and I saw some hunters, and they were throwing decoys on the open water. And I stopped my car and I ran out there, and they were telling me that there was no way in prior years that they would be able to hunt that late in the season. And this was also a big snowmobiling community. And they said a lot of people in that area have had to sell their snowmobiles because they just can't do it anymore.
We all understand that there are ecological costs of changes in the climate. For example, the costs of drought across the globe to humans and plants and animals. And we understand the cost of rising water levels to just about any community that's near water. But are there consequences for a lack of ice that you know of?
Well, I think from a recreation perspective, for sure. It's the fabric of our culture that, for me, is the most important thing, or the thing that I've seen just so dramatically affect who we are as Michiganders and our identity. And so to see someone like my dad not be able to do what he really enjoys doing, and to hear people talk about how they're worried about not being able to pass this tradition down, that is just really sad.
And how are winters different for him these days?
I think it's fishing from the dock. It's fishing from the dock and just trying to be okay with not getting out there as much. One of the other things I wanted to mention that I saw quite a bit that you mentioned in what you were saying is that high water levels too. I mean, that is one of the other effects of not having as much ice, is the ice, without the ice to protect the shorelines, when you get storms coming in, it can cause a lot of damage with the levels of the water. And so almost everywhere I went on the Great Lakes, Lexington, Tawas, homes are being destroyed there. The coastline is being eaten away. It's a really big concern.
Amy Sacca, well, first of all, before I wrap it, Amy Sacca is a photojournalist based in Detroit. Amy, thank you so much for the project. It's amazing to look at, and for all the work you did on it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Weeks have turned into months for the tens of thousands of Michiganders facing the COVID pandemic from nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and other kinds of senior housing. In the early days of the pandemic, facilities and public health officials faced major challenges protecting both the physical and mental health of those residents. Nearly a third of the state's COVID deaths have been in nursing homes. A state task force just released a new report with recommendations on how the state should prepare facilities for future waves of COVID outbreaks. Michigan Radio's Will Callen has been digging into this and joins us now. Hi, Will.
Hi, April.
So the task force's recommendations, are there ways in which they differ from what Governor Gretchen Whitmer's administration was already doing and already recommending?
Yeah, in some ways. So the recommendations, they address the state's entire health system, not just the governor's policy. So running from local health departments to the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. One of the recommendation areas was resource allocation. So it acknowledged that nursing homes were not prioritized during the first wave when it came to PPE or personal protective equipment distribution, and that they should be alongside hospitals. It also said that nursing homes need to have better access to testing, and it even proposed kind of a statewide lab system for the exclusive use of nursing homes if they need testing during a wave. There's also a section about quality of life. You know, people recognize that the other health threat in nursing homes right now is isolation. The report is recommending that we start allowing outdoor visits, which can be done safely at nursing homes. And then, you know, one really notable example of a state policy that's been affirmed is the regional hub policy, which selected nursing homes that had the ability to isolate recovering COVID-19 patients in separate wings.
I know the regional hub policy was super controversial. Can you unpack for us what the report recommends?
Yeah, so in general, it says that the policy worked and should be extended, but what it's saying is that the selection process for these facilities needs to be more rigorous. When the facilities were first selected in April, officials were rushing to get them and their isolation wings opened. And I think that they all appreciate now that we have more time to make sure that homes have adequate staff, have performed well in the past with things like infection control. And so if Whitmer takes that recommendation, we would be seeing entirely new facilities being selected. Another report came out this week, too. It was from the Center for Health and Research Transformation at the University of Michigan, and it focused more specifically on hubs. And even though its results are preliminary, it has so far found that hubs performed pretty well. The group's executive director is Marianne Udow Phillips, and she said that in general, for all nursing homes, what we're finding is that the relationship between these facilities and the state should transition from one that's more based on punishment to one based on collaboration.
I'm hoping that this experience with COVID-19 teaches us that our approach should not be one that's focused on punitive citations, sanctions. It should be one that is approached with training tools and a learning environment.
Well, another issue that the task force's report got to was staffing. And we saw last month there was another nursing home in Metro Detroit whose staff were threatening to strike. What's in this report for staff concerns?
Yeah, so the report acknowledges that being a nurse, especially a certified nursing assistant, is not easy. So it suggests that we guarantee them more paid leave time and give them more training so that they know how to respond to infection outbreaks. And the report does not get into specifics about things like pay increases for these workers.
One more thing. Governor Whitmer's handling of nursing homes has become a big political talking point for Republicans in Lansing. Republicans at the state and some even at the federal level have said Whitmer's executive orders may have put some elderly folks in nursing homes in harm's way or made them more susceptible to infection. Were there ways in which the report addresses those criticisms?
So, yeah, in a way, I mean, by affirming that the regional hub policy worked and actually largely kept residents as safe as possible, it was kind of denying those claims from state Republicans. So to give a little background, Senator Peter Lucido, he introduced a bill in June that would have replaced the regional hub strategy and set up entirely separate recovery facilities throughout the state. And it was fairly clear that this was, you know, politically motivated. What Lucido and other Republicans were doing was they're actually kind of mimicking what was going on at the federal level. There had been similar critiques from, for example, Representative Steve Scalise from Louisiana. He sent Whitmer and other Democratic governors a letter this summer demanding nursing home data. Last week, the U.S. Department of Justice sent a similar letter asking for the same thing and threatening to open a civil rights investigation, which Whitmer said she would comply with, but dismissed as partisan. As for the Michigan Republicans, in a tweet this week, the House Republicans, they responded to the task force report. They called it courageous, and they said it was courageous because it was recommending changes to the governor's policy. This is, frankly, a pretty dishonest interpretation of the report, because the report and the people on it, they worked really closely with the governor, and again, they affirmed that her policies worked in a lot of ways. What I think it shows, actually, is that state Republicans and Democrats are actually on the same page about this issue. They agree about how we need to better protect our seniors.
Will Callen covers COVID and nursing homes for Michigan Radio. Will, thank you so much.
Thanks, April.
We're always glad to hear your takes, whether it's the post-COVID economy, protests, what's happening to kids or seniors during the pandemic, or anything else that's on your mind, send us an email. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page or hit us on Twitter. Our handle is Stateside Radio. And that's Stateside for today. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.